We'll be in Genesis chapter 37 this evening. Genesis chapter 37. We're actually coming into the last portion of the book of Genesis, and we'll find here that we're transitioning over. We're going to be focusing on Joseph from here on out. And the last almost quarter of the book of Genesis has to do with Joseph, which is actually quite interesting. If you look at the breakdown of the book of Genesis and the focus of it, you find that the first several thousand years of creation is passed over in just a handful of chapters. And then we slow down after we come to Abraham. And then we really slow down whenever we get to Joseph. And so with Joseph, we're going to be concentrating on him for the final quarter of the book of Genesis. And one thing that we're going to learn as we go through all of this, we're going to see over and over God working in people's lives, God bringing hardship into their lives, God using that to refine them, to cause them to draw nearer to him and get their eyes upon him. Because as we've been seeing with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, they have the tendency to not really be real close to God for the most part of their lives. They stray pretty regularly. They don't really fit the bill of what we think they should be as the patriarchs. You know, we think of Abraham as being the great hero of faith and Isaac and Jacob as well. And then as we start actually looking at their lives, we find out that their lives wasn't a whole lot different from ours. They made their share of mistakes and messes and all of those things, and all of those God used for their good. And then we look in Joseph's life, and we see nothing different in that, except for he doesn't make the amount of mistakes that they made. I mean, honestly, there is nothing really negative recorded about Joseph, which is interesting. There's not very many people in Scripture that there's nothing bad said about. I mean, think about it for an instance. Who can you find in Scripture that there's nothing bad said about? Jesus? Joseph? You think of anybody else? He's probably the only other one. Daniel and his three friends? Can't really think of anybody else. Definitely not the disciples. Not the patriarchs, not any of the great leaders, not the judges definitely not them. I mean, honestly, and that's a great thing I've mentioned about the Bible several times is God records about even his choicest servants, he records them warts and all. And so we don't really find much wrong with Joseph. And the interesting thing is that there was plenty of things that went wrong in his life. And so if you look at Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, you can look at all the hard times that they had and all the rough patches they had and say, well, yeah, they deserved them. Right? You can say, those are the consequences of your sin, guys. You don't wait on God and you marry up Hagar, yeah, you're going to have problems. You look at the other one, yeah, you're going to have problems. What about Joseph? And he still had problems, even though we don't find anything negative recorded about him. And so we're going to be looking at him in this, like I said, this last quarter of the book of Genesis. But just to get us on track here, I want to just kind of review just a little bit. Last week, we were looking at the record of Jacob and his family as they were living in Canaan. I remember Jacob spent the first good portion of his life in Canaan, and then whenever he made his brother Esau mad at him, he fled and went down to Laban. He got married to four different women while he was there, amassed a great wealth, and he came out. He met Esau, and whenever he met Esau, he was wondering if Esau was still mad 20 years later, and he wasn't. Things were good. And so Jacob became a little bit complacent there. He came short of obedience, and he settled outside of where God told him to. He said, go back to the land of your kindred. He didn't go to the land of his kindred. He went to the land of Shechem, not related to it. And so anyway, that resulted in his daughter being taken by a man of the land, and then two of her brothers scheming and killing the entire city. Not just the man, but the entire city. And we see that Jacob was kind of inactive in all of it. He didn't take a stand. He didn't do anything about it. He just got disappointed afterward and said, oh, this is going to cause us trouble. How unfortunate. You just slaughtered a city, and Jacob says that's going to cause us problems. And so anyway, with all of that, it caused him to have to return back to Bethel. And we saw the principle there that time after time, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, they got away from God and they returned to Bethel. Bethel being the house of God. This is the place where they met with God. And so we see kind of them coming back to him once again. And so God appeared to him once again at Bethel. And then chapter 35 records the death of Deborah, which was Rebekah's nurse, which would have been the one who did a lot of the raising on Jacob. Then Rachel, which was Jacob's wife. Isaac, which was Jacob's father. And so all of them passed away, and so he was losing ties with this world, because we have the tendency, just as he did, to drive our tent pegs in too deep, as the saying goes. We get too rooted and grounded in this world, and that's the way it was going with Jacob. And so he was having ties cut with this world, and it was actually turning him from the things that he was seeking normalcy, seeking dependence on. And honestly, this is just a little bit of a rabbit trail. That might be what God's doing right now with us. We keep talking about the new normal. God's cutting all the ties of things that we hold normal, things that we have founded our lives on, things that we can count on. And so if he can wash away our sandy foundations, it'll force us to look at him to found our lives on. And I hope that's what is happening amongst Christians today, is that just like Jacob, as God took away one thing at a time that he was depending on rather than God, maybe that's what God's doing through this pandemic. So like I said, just a rabbit trail there. But anyway, today we're going to turn, like I said, from Jacob to Joseph. And he's going to be the focus of the rest of the book. And we'll be actually kind of skipping over chapter number 36, just out of pity on myself and on you. Because if you go through chapter 36, it is a record of the genealogy of Esau. And so with that, you've got about 100 different names here. And that's about all it says. And so that's one of the reasons I'm kind of skipping over it. Not a whole lot in there. I mean, you could actually research the names, research where they were at and their lineages and everything. There is some stuff in there. Okay, I don't want to say that God just put that in there for us to skip over. I hate skipping over parts of the Bible. There is some stuff there. I'm just not wanting to quite dig that deep at the moment. If I start digging that deep there, I need to do that everywhere. We'll be there for like 2 years. So anyway, we're going to be skipping over Esau in chapter 36. But a couple notes from chapter 36 is just the fact that God recorded all of Esau's descendants. And he recorded their rising to power and authority in the region. That God was keeping track of them. That God even cares about the wicked. But there's also a huge lesson to us that there's so much Bible that's related to the descendants of Jacob in one chapter to Esau. And the reason for that is that the Bible is the story of God bringing redemption to mankind, and Esau's not part of that picture. Jacob's lineage is. And so chapter 36 is included as well to show Israel who their neighbors would be in the promised land whenever they came out. Because as I've said for the past several weeks, this was written by Moses to the children of Israel as they were coming out of Egypt to let them know where they came from. Remember, they'd been in Egypt for 400 years. By then, they were losing their identity as the children of Abraham. They had been slaves in Egypt. They had been surrounded by all the paganism. They had been surrounded by despair and everything else that was around them. They weren't known for being God's chosen people at that time. And so God's showing them how they came about being in Egypt, who they were before they came to Egypt, and what promises that he had given them. And on top of all that, he was showing him who he was. And so don't lose that fact. Sometimes we get too focused on ourselves in Scripture and we forget that it's ultimately about him. And so it's revealing to them who he was. And so anyway, I'm going to point out just a few things that I've already said, but I just want to kind of bring this to set the stage. But anyway, point out a few things about Jacob's family. As I said, Dinah, it could have been consensual, by the way. Whenever she ended up with Shechem, the son of Hamor, It could have been consensual. Some people theorize that it was, and that shows a little bit of the depravity of Dinah, because we definitely see the depravity of the other sons. Or it could have just been that it was a simple rape. The Bible doesn't tell us for sure. We can't stay dogmatically one side or the other on that one. But anyway, so Dinah had relations with a Canaanite. Her brothers killed all the men of the city. Reuben, as we found out in chapter 35, laid with his father's concubine. And so that's four out of the 13 recorded children of Jacob. Not exactly a promising lot. Not an inspiring history. Not much hope for the family that's supposed to be blessing to all of the nations. Honestly, as you're reading through this and you're starting to read about Abraham's lineage, his family, and you go back to the promises that God made to Abraham and Isaac, you're scratching your head and saying, are you sure about this, God? Do you really think that you can take this mess and bring salvation to mankind? Do you really think you can take this mess and be a blessing to all nations through Isaac and Jacob and Reuben and Gad and Asher and Naphtali and Manasseh and all the other ones I don't remember? Simeon and Reuben, Levi. They're a mess, right? And so, honestly, you're reading through this and you're saying, yeah, I'm just not seeing this as God's people, his chosen people. And so this is one of the points that God's trying to get across to Israel as well. Because this was being recorded for the people who were reading it at that time and the ones that would come after them. And it didn't catch God by surprise what became of Israel. Because Israel became a very arrogant and proud people. And they began thinking that they were above everyone else. You think about whenever Jesus was on the earth, and they started telling Jesus that we're the children of Abraham. Have you read about the children of Abraham? Our fathers are Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Yeah. And they acted like the children of Jacob. Murderers, envious, adulterous. That was Jacob's children. And so they got proud of who they were, and God recorded in the Bible showing them that there was nothing to be proud of. That it was God's mercies. It was his goodness toward them, not because of how good they were, not because they stood head and shoulders above all the Canaanites, but because God was choosing out of the entire world someone to reveal himself to, a lineage for him to come through, not because of their goodness, not because of their deserving, but because of God. And if the Jews weren't so, and I'll say this for Christians as well, if we're not so blind and arrogant to actually take a real good look at ourselves, we'll see that there isn't anything in us, that it's not about us. Because there's a lot of Christians today that act like they deserve to be saved. They act as if God got something good whenever he got them. They quickly forget where they came from. And this is what God was doing through his word here, was revealing to them where they came from. He says, you really want to get prided up? You really want to be arrogant about this? You really want to lift up your great heritage of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Let me tell you about them. And that's not throwing off on them or trying to lift myself up like I'm any better than they are. I'm just showing you what human race is. And this is what we've been learning about in this. And so as we come to Joseph here, we kind of turn a corner. We're going to be finally seeing a good example. And I find it interesting, we'll get to this later on, but that Joseph being the good example, Joseph being the one who there is nothing bad recorded about him, of all the children of Jacob, he is not the one that the Messiah comes from. You ever consider that? Jesus is the Lion of the tribe of Judah. Honestly, if I was God and I was sitting looking and saying, okay, which one of this guy's kids do I want to send my son through? It's not going to be Judah. Joseph, yeah, he's a good one. But I will say this, I'll get ahead of myself slightly. As we look through this, Joseph is one of the most complete types of Christ that we find in the Old Testament. All aspects of his life we can trace back, or almost all aspects, we can trace back to Jesus. We find him pictured I mean, such a good picture, such a good type of Jesus. And by the time we get to the end of the lesson here, I'll bring all that together and back up what I'm saying, okay? But look for it as we go through this and see if you can see him in here. So anyway, Genesis chapter 37. I told you already 15 minutes ago that's where we're going to be at. We finally made it there. So verses 1 and 2 we'll begin with. And it says, "And Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah, and with the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought unto their father their evil report. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because the sons of his, because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a coat of many colors. And when his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him. And Joseph dreamed a dream and told it to his brethren, and they hated him yet the more. And he said unto them, Hear, I pray you, this dream which I have dreamed. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And behold, your sheaf stood around about and made obeisance to my sheaf. And his brethren said to him, Shalt thou indeed reign over us? Or shalt thou indeed have dominion over us? And they hated him yet the more for his dreams and for his words. And he dreamed yet another dream and told his brethren, and said, Behold, I have dreamed a dream more. And behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obeisance to me. And he told it to his father and to his brethren. And his father rebuked him and said unto him, What is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and thy mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee to the earth? And his brethren envied him, but his father observed the sayings, and his brethren went to feed their flock in Shechem." And so I'll quit there for reading right now. But we find pretty quickly that there was not harmony in the house of Jacob. That should pretty well go without saying, considering that he had four wives. He had 13 different children that's recorded. There's other places where it talks about him having daughters, and there's only one daughter that's recorded. Obviously, if you have 13 or 12 sons, there's probably more girls in there. There's not very many people that's going to have 13 or 12 sons and not have a couple extra daughters somewhere. But anyway, that's beside the point. But as we look at this here, we start out with verses 1 and 2, and Joseph is kind of put forward here as being the focus. It says, these are the generations of Jacob, Joseph being 17 years old. Now, last week, we looked a little bit at ages, at time frames and things, and this is where this is going to come into play at. Because Joseph being 17 years old, he was born whenever Jacob wanted to leave Laban the first time. Laban got him to stay for 6 more years for the flocks and herds. So whenever they came out of Haran with Laban there, Joseph would have been about 6 years old. Simple math there, right? He would have been about 6 years old. Now he's 17. They've been dwelling in Canaan for about 11 years. And so anyway, as he's been here for 11 years, that means that his older brothers would be up to 7 years older than him. So he's 17. His oldest brother would have been about 24, 25 years old. That put everything in perspective. So out of all 12 children, because Benjamin, he's younger than Joseph. Out of all 12 children, they are all within that range of 17 to 25 at this time. I often think of them being much older. I don't know why. Maybe it's storybooks and things, you know, all the little story Bibles, and they all have these great big long gray beards. No, they didn't. They would have been 17, 25 years old. And anyway, it says in verse 2, that Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and with the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought unto his father their evil report. And so as they've been there for this amount of time, the children are growing older. It's time for them to start learning the family trade. The older brothers have already been doing it for a while. Joseph gets up to about 17 years old. And it's time for Joseph to start going out and learning how to be a shepherd. I think it's interesting, the Bible specifically says that he is sent out with the sons of the handmaids. And the sons of the handmaids would have been Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. He wasn't sent out with the sons of Leah. because there was always adversity between them, right? Especially them, because mom Rachel, mom Leah did not like each other. Y'all remember all this? Okay, so anyway, they didn't like each other, so the kids didn't like each other. And so Jacob saying, okay, I'm going to send Joseph out with his brothers, the sons of Zilpah and Bilhah here. And so anyway, we find that the other sons lived quite a bit more time in Haran than what Joseph did. And they learned a lot more from Uncle Laban. They learned from Uncle Laban's sons. And we're going to find that they act a lot more like him as well. And so as he goes out to learn the family trade there, he goes out with the concubine's sons. And I want to say at this point in time that there's a lot of people that make an effort to try to tarnish Joseph during this time. They try to make him look bad. And I think some of it goes back to whenever, I don't know about you all, I mean, I was raised up in Sunday school classes and things. And I remember being taught the story of Joseph and the coat of many collars. And hearing it from the point of view of a younger child. So put this kind of through your mind just a little bit. As I was listening, and you may not see it the same way as I do, but I was often seeing it from the point of view of a young child. And here's Joseph, and he's tagging along behind his older siblings. That already gets us thinking a specific way, right? If you're the older sibling, what do you think of your younger ones? Okay? Now, Josie, don't answer that. But, you know, you picture the older siblings going out and the younger ones tagging along behind, and the younger one comes back and tells dad about what the older ones are doing. And so he's often tarnished as looking like some sort of a tattletale. He's coming and he's ruining it because he's telling on his brothers and he's reporting all the evil deeds that his brothers have been doing. But anyway, I figure Jacob probably needed to watch over and try to keep his sons in check here. Because you remember two of them, Simeon and Levi, had slaughtered all the men of Shechem. Not exactly the most trustworthy guys, right? Reuben at some point in time slept with his concubine. And now would be a good time for me to point out here as well that these events in this section of scripture are not necessarily chronological. They took part in or took place in about a 33-year period, but we're not exactly sure what was going on. I don't know if Rachel was alive at this time or if she'd already passed on. I don't know if Reuben had slept with the concubine before or after this. I tend to think after. We're not sure about all of it. We're not sure whenever we start reading about some of the deeds of the brothers, if it took place before or after they sold Jacob and or Joseph into slavery. And so some of these, there are some questions that's left there. And I could try to be dogmatic about it, and I could try to say this is exactly the way. I can't do that. There's not enough Bible to back it up. These are just things that are put in place here, not necessarily chronological. And I've tried to research it out and get the chronology. It doesn't work. Or it hasn't for me. But anyway, I know it took place in that 33-year period from the time that they left Haran till the time that Jacob and his sons came into Egypt. Okay? And Joseph would have been in Egypt for at least 9, probably 11 or 12 years longer. Okay? So anyway, getting back to Joseph being painted as being a tattletale and being the bratty little kid, Joseph or Jacob would have needed to watch over these boys, keep them in check, because they were prone to mischief. He knew what kind of sons that he had and what kind of trouble they got into. By the way, it says that they had went up to Shechem to feed the sheep there. They would have been a good ways north because they had to leave Shechem because they killed the people of Shechem. And now they're back to Shechem feeding the sheep. And that's going to play a role here in just a minute because what would you think as a father, as a mother, sending your children to a place where they're definitely not well liked? There's danger there. He's going to send Joseph up to check on them later on, make sure that they're doing fine, because there's all kinds of evils that could have befell them or all kinds of evil they could have got themselves into. But anyway, whenever we try to paint Joseph as being the mama's boy or the bratty little boy that's telling on his siblings here, we miss out that Joseph was sent to his older brothers and he was away from his father's watchful eye while he was there with them. They were getting into all their wickedness and all their evils. And so the temptation for Joseph to give in to the pressures and to live like his other brothers would have been strong. How often do younger siblings get in trouble because of what their older siblings get them into? They just want to be like their older siblings. Honestly, I think that there's been times with my kids that it doesn't matter what it was that the oldest could tell the youngest, and she would do it just to gain the approval of the older one. Right? That's kind of the way that it's set up amongst children. And so anyway, Joseph was amongst his brethren. They were getting into all kinds of wickedness, all kinds of evil, and Joseph was keeping himself out of it. He was alienating himself from his brothers by not getting into the nonsense that they were getting into, and he was causing them to hate him even more through all that. He had to be courageous to take a stand in that, to keep his nose clean, so to speak. And so he was determined to do right, even though there was astounding pressure for him to do wrong. And I believe it says a lot about the world that we live in today, that we look at it as a bad thing, that Joseph not only wouldn't participate in it, but that he took a stand against it. The world looks at Joseph and they almost have a disdain for Joseph because he didn't do it and he went back and told his dad and said, hey, my siblings are getting into stuff that's going to get them in trouble. That's going to ruin the family name. That's going to come back on you, Dad. And then we look at Joseph badly for it. Does that seem wrong for you? Or maybe I'm the only one that looks at it that way. But anyway, he's demonized for doing right. But not only did he not conform to their evil ways, he didn't cover up for them either. He didn't conform, he didn't cover up. And in the evil world we live in, this is a good lesson for us as well. We have to aim to have the boldness to not conform, but also on top of that, not to try to cover for those who do. And where this really comes into play is think about it today, all the scandals that we have heard in religious groups and religious organizations, the Catholic Church, not even them, just them, but even amongst so-called good churches, Christian communities and things, and there is a tendency to cover up any wickedness that goes on. Sweep things under the rug. Been a lot of churches in the States that I know of that someone, the pastor, would get into some kind of nonsense that he shouldn't be in. And rather than turning him into the authorities, rather than taking care of it properly or something like that, they keep it quiet and shuffle him off somewhere else. Think about it in the context of Joseph. Joseph would have no part of their wickedness, and not only that, he stood against their wickedness. That's an example for us as well. We shouldn't be covering up for the sins of others. Now, I'm not saying that we need to go out and to be all pious and holier than thou and point out everybody else's flaws. That's definitely not biblical either, okay? So don't get me wrong on that one, but we shouldn't conform to evil nor cover for those who do. Now, as we get to verse 3 and 4, it says, Israel loved Joseph more than all his children. Honestly, that's just a hard part of Scripture to read. This is just one more time we see the result of polygamy. Having a favorite child, having a favorite wife, having all this turmoil in the home. And so Israel loved Joseph more than all of his children because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colors. And when his brethren saw that his father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him. And so as we see here, of course, like I said, favoritism is always wrong whenever it comes to children. But in giving Joseph this coat of many colors, it sent a message to his brothers. We often look at this and just think it was an extravagant gift to the favorite child. We put ourselves in that place and think about what we would feel like if, you know, Christmas comes around and our sibling got just a wonderful gift and it's like, okay, here's a card. That would be bad, wouldn't it? Christmas comes around and mom gives you gives your sibling a brand new car and you get a greeting card, right? That wouldn't go over too well with you, would it? But that's how we often look at it with Joseph and just think, okay, he got a really nice coat. But there's actually more that's being said than just that. Because whenever he gave him this coat, whenever it was clear that he loved Joseph above all the other brothers, it was also indicating who was going to be the one who inherited the blessing. This gets us back into previous discussions, previous chapters, where we looked at Isaac and Abraham and the fights over the familial blessings. The one who had received the double portion, the one who would receive the father's estate, right? We go back to Abraham and Isaac, and Abraham gave all of his other children gifts and good things, sent them away, and then gave his entire estate to Isaac, right? Then we get to Jacob and Esau, and Esau kind of got shoved out of the way there. Jacob connived his way to get the blessing and the birthright. And so at the end, he was blessed, and Esau was alienated at the end of that. Now we come down to Joseph, and as Jacob gives Joseph this coat, it's showing him the position of favor, the position of blessing here, indicating that he's going to be the one who receives the blessing. He's going to be the one that receives the birthright. He's going to be the one who his father favors. And after all, is he not the firstborn son of who was supposed to be his first wife? And so with all that, the brothers are looking at him and they're scratching their head and they're saying, you know how this is going to go. He goes from being the youngest son to being the one who's going to be ruling over them. Also, whenever we look at the birthright and blessing, we think of it as being just a material possession. We think of, okay, he gets the farm, he gets the herds, he gets the wealth. On top of that, he is also going to be the head of the family, the leader of the clan. It's a position of authority. And he's also going to be the priest for the family. It's a spiritual blessing as well, because this was before the time of the priesthood. Remember, we look at Job offering up offerings for all of his children. We see Abraham doing the same thing. Several different fathers there offering up and representing their family before God. And so this was passing the mantle, so to speak, to Joseph. And so all of these things were brewing in their brothers' minds here. And it says they hated him and they could not speak peaceably to him. They didn't have a kind word for him. And so anyway, as all this was going on, the hatred was brewing, the animosity, the ridicule, I can imagine the times that he got beat up, because I had an older brother, I got beat up. I can imagine times he got beat up. I can imagine the things that were said to him and different things. Because of all this, there would have been definitely turmoil in that household. And if these things weren't enough to cause his brothers to hate him, on top of that, he had dreams and told them about him. I look at Joseph and I think, man, you should have just kept your mouth shut. If he has these dreams, he should have just kept them to himself. But he goes and has these dreams and he gets excited about it. And he tells the whole family. And I already read it there a minute ago. But as he tells the family, he says, hey, I had this dream last night. And I saw all these sheaves in the field. They were binding these sheaves, these bundles of wheat. And they were all laying out in the field. And my sheaf stood up. And there was all of your all sheaves out in the field. And they stood up and they bowed to me. They bowed to my sheaf. They didn't need a dream interpretation class. They didn't need a book. Didn't need some kind of course. They knew what it meant. As soon as they heard all of this, they said, you're crazy. There's no way that we're going to bow to you. There's no way that you're going to rule over us. And they already hated him. They already saw him being the favorite. And they probably saw this as him being arrogant, as him being boastful, maybe a little out of his place here. And so they hated him even more because of his dreams. Then on top of that, he had another dream, and it said that it was sun, moon, and 11 stars bowed to him. How stars bow, I don't know. Okay? But anyway, they came and they bowed to him. And once again, they knew exactly what it meant. And even his father rebuked him and said, shall your mother and I, which leads me to think maybe this was before Rachel was dead, but then it said 11 stars as well, so that would have meant that Benjamin was alive. So who knows? Maybe Rachel was pregnant at the time. That's what I'm saying. We can't get an exact timeline on this, can we? And so anyway, it says the sun, moon, 11 stars bow to me. And his father rebukes and basically says, you really need to be quiet about this. You're making everybody mad. And he's excited about it. Of course, God's revealing things to him. You ever been in a place where God was revealing things to you and you were growing spiritually and other people got mad at you because of it? Anyway, that's a side note. And so anyway, whenever we look at these two dreams, we see that the bundles of wheat talk about physical provision, talk about the taking care of physical needs and provision on that. And then the sun, moon, and stars are always a picture of power, of ruling. You look at whenever God first creates the sun, moon, and stars, it says that he creates the greater light to rule the day, lesser light, the moon and the stars, to rule the night. It talks about ruling, right? And so as he is now being bowed to by the sheaves and by the sun, moon, and stars, of course we know the rest of the story, right? It's not too long he's going to be in Egypt. Whenever he's in Egypt, he is elevated in authority, in a rulership position, and his brothers come and bow to him. His whole family comes and bows to him. Dream comes true. Not only that, the wheat comes into play because they're coming after provision, after nourishment from him. Because they're about to starve to death in Canaan, and they come to him for grain. And they bow to him. And so anyway, they would bow to him. They didn't know it yet, but God did. Which is, that's another interesting thing to point out there, is as God is revealing it, we can see it plainly now. They didn't have a clue back then. But it shows that God already knew. And so the very idea that Joseph would rule over them disgusted them, and they would have scorned him even more for his perceived arrogance for him to come to him with such things. How dare him say that? And so anyway, that brings us to verse number 12. I believe that's where we left off at as we were reading through. Verse number 12, his brethren went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. As I said before, that's where Simeon and Levi had killed all the men of that city. Now they're feeding sheep up there. His brother went to feed his father's flock in Shechem, and Israel said unto Joseph, do not thy brethren feed the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send thee unto them. And he said unto him, here am I. And he said to him, go, I pray thee, see whether it be well with thy brethren, and well with the flocks, and bring me word again. So he sent him out of the vale of Hebron, and he came to Shechem, and a certain man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. That's just kind of a funny picture to me. He sends him to Shechem, and he's just wandering in the field. And the man finds him and says, are you lost, boy? He says, my brethren are supposed to be around here somewhere feeding sheep. Describes his brother and says, oh, yeah, they already left. They went to Dothan. And so anyway, a certain man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field, and the man asked him, saying, what seekest thou? And he said, I seek my brethren. Tell me, I pray thee, where they feed their flocks. And the man said, they are departed hence, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. And Joseph went after his brethren and found them in Dothan. And so as we come to this point, Joseph is the dependable and the obedient son that his father called him to run an errand for him. Of course, with his sons being as untrustworthy and as mischievous as what they were, Jacob wanted to check up on them. He wanted to see what was going on. All kinds of danger could befall them at Shechem. And honestly, those boys, you couldn't leave them alone by themselves for very long or they would get into trouble. Who knows what family they've slaughtered by now, right? Who knows what kind of trouble they've gotten into? It could have been that they were going too long, or it could have been that he hadn't heard from them in enough time. Maybe he thought, it's been awful quiet. I haven't received any word from my sons for a while. Wonder if everything's okay. And so he calls to Joseph, and Joseph says, here am I, always ready, reporting for duty, right? And so he sent Joseph to check on them. And I try to put myself in Joseph's position here. Joseph knows his brothers hate him. He knows they're far from the father. He knows that whenever he gets there, he's not going to be well received because he's seen as being the tattletale. He's seen as being daddy's boy, right? And so if he's going there, he's not going to have a whole lot of protection. There's going to be all of his brothers versus him. And not only that, he has the lonely trip to take between there and Dothan. And so what does he do? He doesn't say, Dad, I don't think that's a good idea. Dad, I don't think this will turn out well for me. Dad, you know how my brothers hate me. He didn't say any of those things, did he? He went. And so he took the lonely job willingly, knowing he was going to be amongst those who hated him. And so as he was getting ready to arrive, in verse 18 it says, "And when they saw him afar off, even before he came near unto them, they conspired against him to slay him. And they said unto one another, Behold, this dreamer cometh. Come now, therefore, let us slay him and cast him into some pit, and we will say some evil beast hath devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams." Being good shepherds that they were looking out around them. They were paying, and they were watching for enemies, and they saw Joseph as an enemy. As they seen him coming, they had plenty of time, apparently, out of there in the plains where they were at, had plenty of time to hatch this plan. And they said, "Here he is, he's by himself, there's no witnesses, no one else around but us, let's kill him. We'll bury him in a pit, we'll dip his clothing in blood. After we dip his clothing in blood, we'll tell Dad that, hey, some wild animal ate him. We'll be rid of him." And then it's really telling the last thing that they said in verse number 20, "We shall see what will become of his dreams." They didn't realize that God was revealing what he was going to do ahead of time, and there was no way they could thwart it. And so anyway, as they conspired and as they made their plans to kill him, we find that Reuben steps up in verse number 21. Reuben's the oldest. It says, "Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, Let us not kill him. And Reuben said unto them, Shed no blood, but cast him into this pit, that is here, or that is in the wilderness, and lay no hand upon him, that he might rid him out of their hands to deliver him to his father again." And so, as Reuben steps up to try once again to scheme a way to rescue Joseph, he's the leader of the family, right? He's the oldest son. He should have been the one that would step in and take charge. But we find out that he's his father's son. Just as Jacob, time after time, did not step in and his inactivity cost him, Reuben was the same way. He wasn't assertive, but he wouldn't step in. He wouldn't take responsibility. And so he said, "Let's not kill him. Let's throw him in the pit. And then we'll figure out what to do with him later on." And he just assumed that they would go, they would get distracted. Reuben would help him out of the pit, send him on his way. That way, Jacob didn't die. Now, this is the same Reuben that had laid with his father's concubine. And once again, we don't know if this was before or after. We don't know which one happened. I tend to think that this happened before the concubine. And I think that he estranged himself and he put the distance between himself with guilt and shame in what he allowed to happen that allowed him to be alienated enough that he would do this to his father. That's just my opinion. Okay? But anyway, so Reuben talks him into, don't kill him immediately. Let's throw him in the pit. I'll rescue him later on. And honestly, what he's doing, he's trying to play both sides. He doesn't want to look bad in front of his brothers by trying to help out the one that they hate. But then on the other side, he doesn't want to kill someone either. Now, Simeon and Levi, they're fine with that. Done it before. And so in verse 23 through 28, it says, "And it came to pass when Joseph was come unto his brethren that they stripped Joseph of his coat of many colors that was on him. And they took him and cast him into a pit. And the pit was empty, and there was no water in it. And they sat down to eat bread, and they lifted up their eyes and looked, and behold, a company of Ishmaelites." Hey, they're family, right? "Company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead with their camels bearing spicery and balm and myrrh, going to carry it down to Egypt. And Judah said to his brethren, What profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother in our flesh. And his brethren were content." It says, "And there passed by the Midianites, merchant men, and they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit, and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, and they brought Joseph into Egypt." And so, as they put him in the pit and as they waited around, it just so happened that this caravan of merchants came through. Something I want to point out in all of this is how many times that God intervened on things that just so happened. Because they had determined they were going to kill him. If they didn't kill him, they were going to leave him in the pit until he died. Right? And it just so happened that the merchantmen came by. We look at that and say, hey, he got sold into slavery. That's horrible. He beats what they had planned for him. Sometimes God brings deliverance wrapped in strange packages. Sometimes it looks like an Ishmaelite caravan. And so as they came through, it played upon their greed and on their selfishness. And they said, you know, we could just kill him. But you know, we don't have to kill him. We can sell him. If we sell him, we get money. He's gone. And we didn't kill him. We don't have blood on our hands. We don't have a guilty conscience. We can think that, hey, he got sold into slavery. He's some servant doing some kind of a cushy job for some royal person down in Egypt. Maybe he'll end up even escaping. Maybe he might have a good life down in Egypt, and they could have told themselves all sorts of lies, right? Whatever they needed to salve their conscience. And so they said, yeah, we'll sell him down to Egypt. It'll be great. Each of us gets 2 pieces of silver. We don't have to kill anybody. And Joseph's gone. Problem is solved. And so this is what they do, and they pull him out. They put him in this caravan. They drag him off to Egypt. Would not have been a pleasant job or a pleasant experience here. He probably would have been tied up like an animal to the back of some sort of a car, just led through the desert. But he wasn't dead. And on top of that, we know now what laid ahead of him. As Joseph was tied together, betrayed by his own family, doing the will of his father, now trudging through the desert, stripped of his coat, tied up like an animal, headed to a new life that he had no clue what was ahead of him. Every step of the way, he's trying to figure out, where is God? What's he doing? I tried to do my best. I've been a good boy. Right? And yet, here I am, being sold as a slave. It didn't look like deliverance, did it? We'll see as we go onward that it was deliverance, that God had a plan that he never would have imagined. And so in verse 29, Reuben returns to the camp because he was going whenever the caravan came through. We don't know if he was going buying supplies, where he was about. Maybe he was in the local town getting into some sort of nonsense because they were apt to do that. But he comes back in verse 29 and it says, and Reuben returned into the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit. And he rent his clothes. Apparently he gets to the pit before he gets to his brothers. And he realizes the boy's not there anymore. Joseph is gone. And he assumes the worst. He assumes they killed him and buried him while I was gone. I was the only thing that stood between him and death. And I left and they killed him. And so he ripped his clothes, a sign of mourning. And it says here in verse number 30. And he returned unto his brethren and said, the child is not, and whither shall I go? Once again, just like his father, he's not so concerned about the child, but what's going to happen to him. I'm the oldest son. I'm the one who's responsible. I'm the one in charge. How is this going to look on me, guys? And they took Joseph's coat and killed a kid of the goats and dipped the coat in the blood. And they sent the coat of many colors and they brought it to their father and said, this have we found. Know now whether it be thy son's coat or no. And Jacob rent his clothes and put sackcloth upon his loins. Verse 33. And he knew it and said, it is my son's coat. An evil beast hath devoured him. Joseph is without doubt rent in pieces. And Jacob rent his clothes and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. So they continue on with their deceptive plan, right? They said, okay, let's dip it in blood. We'll send it back to dad by the hand of the messenger, whether it was one of the other brothers, whether it was a servant, I don't know. But they send back the coat, and they said, hey, we found this out in the wilderness somewhere. Does this belong to Joseph? They didn't say that they found it on Joseph's back and that they were the ones that dipped it in blood. They told a half-truth. Right? They never said that a wild animal killed Joseph. They just made it look that way. and allowed Jacob to come to his own conclusions. And so as they showed the blood-dipped coat to Jacob, Jacob saw it and said, "Surely Joseph has been ripped into a million pieces by some wild animal," and he began mourning over it. And the boys were probably all smiling at each other, laughing and saying, "We never told him that's what happened. We never said that he got killed by an animal. He came up with that on his own. We didn't have to lie. We didn't kill anyone. We're pretty good people." Can you imagine? But it says that he put sackcloth on his loins. He mourned many days. In verse 35, "And all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him." By the way, there's all of his daughters. "Rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, 'For I will go down into the grave unto my son mourning.' Thus his father wept for him." Now the sons begin to have a little bit of regrets. They see the pain that it caused their father, but they're in too deep now. They're not turning back. Could you imagine them now saying, "Sorry, Dad, he didn't really die. We sold him as a slave." They're not going to do that. And so they let their poor father carry on for 20 years. That's how long it is. For 20 years, because he's not going to see his son Joseph alive until Joseph is 39 years old. At this time, he would have been around, I said a minute ago, 17. A couple of years may have came by after that. So 19 years old when all this happened. It's going to be 20 years before his dad realizes that he's still alive. And he's going to mourn for 20 years. And his sons are going to allow it to happen. And so anyway, he refused to be comforted. By this time, he's lost Rachel. He's lost Deborah. He's lost his father, Isaac. And he may have even lost, lost his favorite wife, Rachel, by now. And so that all sets the stage for chapter number 39. Verse 36 says, "And the Midianites sold him into Egypt, unto Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh's and a captain of the guard." That tells us what we're going to pick up in chapter number 39. But we have 38 in between that. As we detour through chapter 38, we find the wickedness of another one of Jacob's sons, Judah. And so we're going to read about that next week. We're definitely not getting into that tonight, but and we're going to see what kind of a man Judah was. And we kind of see how God is putting the book of Genesis together, surrounding him and showing the people of Israel what kind of children that Jacob had. We've seen Simeon, we've seen Levi, we've seen Reuben, we're going to see Judah, right? We've seen that the four sons of the concubines, Gad, Naphtali, Asher, and whatever the other one was I said earlier, that Joseph was bringing back the evil report from them. So we're up to, what, 9 of the kids out of 13? None of which I really would want to be my next-door neighbor. And so anyway, all these instances should have an effect on the Jews whenever they heard them. They should clearly be able to see that it was not by works of righteousness which they had done, but according to his mercy that they saved us, as it says in Titus chapter 3 and verse 5. And same thing goes for us. We should be able to see that as well. And so I said I was going to bring this all together at the end and tell you a little bit about why Joseph is such a good picture of Christ. Because we see that Joseph was the beloved of his father. He was sent amongst his brother that hated him. Right? He went into the world that hated them. They received him not. Instead, they lied on him. They sold him for the price of a slave. Right? Sold him as the price of a slave to the Gentiles. Right? And so anyway, he ended up, of course, Joseph wasn't killed at that time. But he was presumed to be dead. He was falsely accused. He was put in prison. We can even look that Reuben half-heartedly tried to deliver him, much like Pilate did. Right? And then, after all of it was said and done, he brings salvation to all of his brethren and he's exalted as king. Several other things that I could point out in between that. Many other things that I could point out in between that. Even after that, we find that he receives a Gentile bride. That's us. Several other things that I could bring together there. But anyway, we see how much of a picture he is of Christ in the Old Testament. And it kind of gives you an idea of why a quarter of the book of Genesis is dedicated to him, even though he is not part of the line of the Messiah. He may not be part of his lineage, but boy, he's a good picture of it. So does anyone have any questions or any comments or anything to add to what we said this evening? I've already said it all. Okay. Well, if nobody has anything, we'll go ahead and we'll close in a word of prayer and call it an evening. Lord, we come to you this evening. Thank you for your blessings. Lord, we do thank you for the time that we spend in your word. I pray, Lord, that something that I've said, something from your word has been a help to each and every person here this evening. Pray, Lord, for your strength and your help, Lord, as we go throughout this week. Lord, help us to be a light to those that we come in contact with. Help us to draw closer to you. Help us to depend upon you. Help us to see you for who you really are and ourselves for who we really are. And Lord, we just thank you so much for all that you do. Thank you so much that you love us enough, that you would bleed and die for us, that you would offer salvation to whosoever will. And we just love you and we praise you for all you do. And all these things I pray in Jesus' name. And amen.